It backwards. That's my problem.
Put it in neutral and we'll push it.
That word again.
Tomas is not sure why the machine's neutrality will allow it to move backwards, but Simão seems to know what he's talking about.
It's already in neutral. Only the handbrake needs to be released, Tomas says.
He puts his shoes back on and climbs into the driving compartment. With a sore hand, he releases the handbrake. Nothing happens. He doubts Simão's quick fix will yield anything more fruitful than his own tree-chopping solution.
Come, says Simão.
Tomas joins him at the front of the automobile. This notion of pushing the automobile is preposterous. Still, to be polite to the man who has so obligingly helped him and is now ready beside him to push, he places a shoulder against the automobile.
One, two, three, cries Simão,
and he pushes, and Tomas too, though not very hard. To his amazement, the automobile moves. He's so amazed, in fact, that he forgets to move with it, and he falls flat on his face. In a matter of seconds, the vehicle stands three lengths from the tree.
Simão is beaming.
What an astonishing machine!
Yes, it is, says Tomas, incredulous.
As he picks himself up off the ground, he discreetly takes hold of the axe. Placing it close to his leg, he returns it to the cabin. Simão is still gazing at the automobile with unbounded admiration. Tomas would like nothing better than to stay where he is for the night, but the prospect of Casimiro arriving on the scene and having to explain the attack on his quarter-millennium olive tree strongly advises against the option. Besides, he's lost. If he stays the night, he will still be lost in the morning.
Simão, I was wondering if you might help me find my way out of here. I seem to have got lost.
Where do you want to go? Tunisia?
No, I've just come from there. I'm heading for Vila Velha de Rodau.
Vila Velha? You have got very lost. But it's no problem. I know the way.
That's wonderful. Might you help me start the automobile?
With the condition his hands are in, the idea of having to turn the starting handle makes Tomas feel faint. He supposes Simão will take pleasure in it. He's right. The peasant's face breaks into a wide grin.
Yes, of course. What do you want me to do?
Tomas shows him the starting handle and the direction in which to turn it. As the machine explodes to life, Simão might as well be struck by lightning. The effect is the same. Tomas waves at him to get into the driving compartment, and Simão scampers aboard. Tomas puts the vehicle into first gear, and as it moves forward, he glances at his passenger. His face confirms what Tomas already suspected from watching his uncle. The machine turns grown men into little boys. Simão's weathered features are transformed by delight. If he shrieked and giggled, Tomas would not be surprised.
Which way should I go?
He asks. Simão points. Every few minutes, Simão corrects his course, and soon the trace of a track appears. Then a proper track, smoother and verged. The driving becomes easier and faster. Simão's delight continues undiminished. After a good half hour of driving, they reach a true, blessed road. Tomas stops the automobile.
I never thought I'd be so happy to see a road. So which way is Vila Velha de Rodau? He asks.
Simão indicates to the right.
Thank you very much, Simão. You've been of invaluable help. I must reward you.
Tomas reaches into the pocket of his charred jacket. Simão shakes his head. With a struggle, as if his tongue has been lost deep inside his body, he speaks.
My reward is having been in this amazing carriage. It is I who thank you.
It's nothing. I'm sorry I've taken you so far out of your way.
It's not so far on foot.
Simão reluctantly vacates the passenger seat, and Tomas prods the machine onward.
Thank you again, he shouts.
Simao waves until he disappears from view in the side mirror. Shortly thereafter, with a dragging to one side and a fluff, 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 fluff sound, Tomas realizes that something is wrong. He presses on one pedal, then another. It takes a few walkabouts around the vehicle before he sees that the front right tire is, he searches for the word, flat. The roundness of the wheel is no longer so round. There were some pages in the manual about this eventuality. He skipped them when it became apparent that the wheels, in their roundness at least, did not require lubrication. He retrieves the manual and finds the appropriate section. He blanches. This is serious engineering work. He can see that even before he has translated the details from the French. Understanding the nature and operation of the jack, assembling it, finding where it must be placed under the automobile, jacking the automobile up, unbolting and removing the wheel, replacing it with the spare wheel from the footboard, tightly bolting the fresh wheel into place, returning everything to its proper place. An experienced motorist might do it in half an hour. It takes him, with his raw hands, 2 hours. At last, his hands sullied and throbbing, his body sweating and aching, the task is done. He should be pleased that he can proceed again, but all he feels is mortal exhaustion. He retreats to the driving compartment and stares out in front of him. His head is prickly, as is the unwanted beard that is growing on his face. "Enough! Enough!" he whispers. What does suffering do to a man? Does it open him up? Does he understand any more as a result of his suffering? In the case of Father Ulysses, for the longest time it seems the answer to these questions was no. Tomas remembers a telling incident. "Today I saw a fight on a plantation. Two slaves clashed. Others stood about with stupefied expressions. A female slave, the object of contention, looked on impassive, indifferent. Whoever won, she would lose. Continually shouting in their native gibberish, the two fought, at first with words and gestures, then their fists, then their tools. The matter proceeded swiftly from injured prides to injured bodies, from bruising and bleeding to frenzied hacking, till the end was reached. A dead slave, with a torso cleft with deep cuts and a half-severed head. Whereupon the other slaves, the female included, turned and got back to their work, lest the overseer arrive on the scene. The victor slave, his visage apathetic, threw some soil on the body, then returned to cutting cane. None of the slaves will come forward to acknowledge or explain, to accuse or defend. Just silence and the hoeing of sugar cane. The dead man's decay will be rapid, started by insects and predatory birds and beasts, and accelerated by the sun and rain. Soon nothing but a lump will be left of him. Only if the overseer directly steps onto this lump will its gashed blackness reveal white bones and decaying red flesh. Then the overseer will know the whereabouts of the slave who went missing." Of this appalling scene, Father Ulysses has only one significant comment to make. "Such were the Lord's wounds, like that dead slave's injuries, his hands, his feet, his forehead where the crown of thorns pierced his skin, and especially the wound on his side from the soldier's spear, carmine red, very, very bright, a pull on the eyes." Such was the suffering of Christ, carmine red, and a pull on the eyes. But the suffering of the two men who fought to death before his very eyes? They are not worth a word. No more than the spectator slaves would Father Ulysses come forward to acknowledge or explain, to accuse or to defend. He seems to have been deaf and dumb to the suffering of the slaves. Or, to be more accurate, he seems to have seen nothing peculiar about it. They suffer, but so do I. So what of it?
The land begins to change as Tomas drives on. The Portugal that he knows is a land solemn in its beauty, a land that prizes the sound of work, both human and animal, a land devoted to duty. Now an element of wilderness begins to intrude. Great outcrops of round rocks, dark green vegetation that is dry and scrubby, wandering flocks of goats and sheep. He sees the high mountains of Portugal foreshadowed in these extrusions of rocks, like the roots of a tree that break above ground, heralding the tree itself. He is fretful. He is approaching Castelo Branco, which is a proper city, the largest on his deliberately rural route. An idea strikes him. He will drive through the city in the middle of the night. Thus he will avoid people, because it is people who are the problem. Streets, avenues, boulevards, these he can handle if people aren't staring and shouting and congregating. If he crosses Castelo Branco at, say, 2 in the morning, in full throttle third gear, he will likely meet only the odd night shift worker or drunkard. When Castelo Branco is near, he leaves the automobile behind and makes his way into the city on foot, backwards, as always. He hitches a ride with a man driving a cart, which is fortunate, as the distance to the city turns out to be considerable. The man asks if he saw the strange carriage down the road. He says that he did, without mentioning that he is its driver. The man speaks of the machine in terms of wonder and worry. It's the quantity of metal that surprises him, he says. It reminds him of a safe. In Castelo Branco, Tomás determines the route he should take. He is pleased to discover that the road continuing to the north of the country mostly avoids the city, circling it on its northwest side. Only the junction with the road is tricky. He tells 3 apothecaries his horse's afflicted with lice story, which gets him 10 bottles of motonaptha and, as an unfortunate corollary, 3 tins of horse lice powder. He carries these in 2 bags, evenly balanced. He decides to check into a hotel for the day to wash himself and rest, but the 2 hotels he finds refuse to admit him, as does the restaurant he seeks to eat in. The proprietors look him up and down, study his singed face and burned hair. One pinches his nose, and they all point to the door. He is too tired to protest. He buys food from a grocer and eats on a bench in a park. He drinks water from a fountain, gulping it avidly, splashing it over his face and head, scrubbing at the soot plastered to his scalp. He wishes he'd remembered to bring the 2 wineskins which he could have filled with water. Then he walks in reverse back to the automobile, watching Castelo Branco recede into the distance. He waits in the cabin for night to fall, idly leafing through the diary to pass the time. The provenance of the slaves on São Tomé was at first a matter of concern and interest to Father Ulysses. He named the newcomers' origins in his diary, from the Umbundu tribe, or the Chokwe tribe. But he was hazier on the origins of slaves who came from outside the Portuguese sphere of influence in Africa, and São Tomé, being usefully located, saw slave ships of every nationality. Dutch, English, French, Spanish, and soon he grew weary as a result of the slaves' 2 great numbers. They received his weakening blessing in a state of increasing anonymity. "Does it matter," he wrote, "where from a soul comes? The exiles of Eden are varied. A soul is a soul, to be blessed and brought to the love of God." But one day there was a change. Father Ulysses wrote with uncharacteristic excitement, "I am at the port when a Dutch slaver is unloading its stock. 4 captives catch my eye. I see them from afar as they shuffle down the gangplank in shackles and chains. What poor souls are these? They walk with a listless gait, their backs bent, their will broken. I know how they feel. My exhaustion and theirs is the same. The fever is upon me again.
Jesus reached out to all, Romans, Samaritans, Syro-Phoenicians, and others. So must I. I want to get closer, but am too weak, the sun too bright. A sailor from the ship is passing by. I beckon to him. I point and ask, and he tells me that the captives come from deep within the Congo River basin and were captured in a raid, not traded by a tribe. 3 females and a child. My Dutch is poor, and I don't fully understand the sailor. I believe he uses the word minstrel. They are to be entertainers of some sort. He gives no sense of impropriety to the term. What? I say to him. Straight from the jungles of the Congo to amusing the white man after his dinner in the New World? He laughs. I have learned that the 4 are now jailed on Garcia's plantation. The mother of the child attacked an overseer and was severely beaten for the offense. They were unwilling to put on clothes, and it seemed they provided poor entertainment. Their fate will be decided shortly. Though I am so feeble I cannot stay long on my feet, I went to Garcia's today and slipped in to see his captives in their dark, hot cell. The rebellious female has died of her injuries. Her body was still there, her child at her side, listless, nearly unconscious. Fruit lay rotting on the ground. Are the 2 females that remain starving themselves to death? I spoke to them, knowing they would not understand me. They did not respond or even seem to hear me. I blessed them. I have gone again. The stench. The child is most certainly dead. At first I had no greater success with the 2 survivors than yesterday. I read to them from the Gospel of Mark. I chose Mark because it is the most humble gospel, revealing a Messiah at his most human, racked by doubt and anxiety, while still shining with loving kindness. I read until fatigue, the heat, and the stench nearly overcame me. Thereafter I sat in silence. I was about to leave when one of the captives, the youngest, an adolescent female, stirred. She crawled and settled against the wall on the other side of the bars from me. I whispered to her, O Señor, te ama, filia, donde tu vench? Conchime sobre o jalgim do ethen. Contame tua historia. O que visemos de echado. She did not react in any way. A time passed. Then she turned her head and looked me in the eyes. She looked only briefly before moving away. She guessed that she had nothing to gain from my nearness or interest. I said not a word. My tongue was stilled of any priestly cant. I am transformed. I saw. I have seen. I see. That short gaze made me see a wretchedness that until then had never echoed in my heart. I entered that cell thinking I was a Christian man. I walked out, knowing I was a Roman soldier. We are no better than animals. When I returned this day, they were dead, their bodies taken away and burned. They are free now, as they should have been all along.
The next entry in Father Ulysses' diary is fierce and accusatory, outlining the final rift between him and the island's civil and religious authorities. He made a scene at the cathedral, interrupting the mass with his shouts and protests. The consequence was swift.
I was summoned by the bishop today. I told him that I had met the unequal, and in meeting them found them equal. We are no better than they, I told him. In fact, we are worse. He yelled at me that as there are hierarchies of angels in heaven and of the damned in hell, so there are hierarchies here on earth. The boundaries are not to be blurred. I was sent off, struck by his harshest thunderbolt, excommunication.
In his eyes I am no longer a man of the cloth, but yet I feel the Lord's hand holding me up.
Tomas is amazed, as he is every time he reads this passage. To exclude French and English pirates or Dutch sailors, little more than mercenaries, from the communion of God is one thing. But an ordained Portuguese priest? That seems an extreme measure, even by the standards of São Tomé. But a place that made its living off slavery would think poorly of a fevered emancipator. It is then that Father Ulysses mentioned the gift for the first time. Tomas always reads the sentence with trepidation.
I know my mission now. I will make this gift to God before death takes me. I thank God that I drew a sketch while I was at Garcia's, visiting her in her hellish confinement. Her eyes have opened mine. I will bear witness to the wreckage we have wrought. How great is our fall from the garden!
Tomas turns the page and stares for the thousandth time at the sketch in question. It is this sketch with its haunting eyes that set him on his search. Night has settled on the land and the time has come to drive through Castelo Branco. He lights the remaining sidelight and adjusts its broad wick. The flame that dances up sheds a circle of warm light. The brilliantly white flame of the surviving headlight hisses like an angry snake. Its illumination is focused forward by a crystal glass encasement. If only the light cast by the headlight weren't so lopsided. His cyclops looks rather sorry. He reviews the route he will take. He has a series of markers in his head. At each point where a decision needs to be made, he has taken note of a detail, a house, a shop, a building, a tree. Because there will be no throngs of people at this time of night, he will have more leisure to guide himself correctly. Whatever illusion he has that he's riding a firefly of sorts, and when he moves away from the vehicle's lit side, its radiance gives that image some credibility, is shattered when he starts up the machine. Its juddering roar rather brings to mind a dragon, although one with puny flames shooting from its mouth. Not only puny, wholly ineffective. The lights, bright to his eyes close up, are mere pinpricks in the impenetrable night. All the headlight does, and poorly at that, is bring out the rough features of the road immediately under the automobile's nose. What lies beyond, every rut, every turn, comes as a frightening, ever-changing surprise. His only recourse, wholly illogical, he knows, but he can't help himself and does it over and over, is to squeeze the horn as if the night were a black cow obstructing the road that will jump out of the way with a few honks. He does not move beyond first gear as he gropes his way towards Castelo Branco. In Portugal, the sunshine is often pearly, lambent, tickling, neighborly. So, too, in its own way, is the dark. There are dense, rich, and nourishing pockets of gloom to be found in the shadows of houses, in the courtyards of modest restaurants, on the hidden sides of large trees. During the night, these pockets spread, taking to the air like birds. The night in Portugal is a friend. These are the days and nights that he has mostly known. Only in his distant childhood was the night ever a breeder of terrors. Then he quaked and cried out. His father came to his rescue each time, stumbling half asleep to his bed where he would take him in his arms. He would fall asleep against his father's big, warm chest. Castelo Branco does not have the streetlights that light up Lisbon's nights. Every marker on his route, so clear during the day, is now shrouded. Streets rear up like the tentacles of a giant squid. He never finds the road that skirts the city on its northwest. Instead, Castelo Branco is a breeder of terrors. He tries to hold a course in one direction until he reaches the city's edge, any edge, but every street he takes ends in a T-junction, either way plunging him back into the depths of the city. Worse are the people. Like the houses and buildings that surround him, they appear abruptly out of the darkness, their faces suddenly fixed by the white light of the one-eyed machine. Some shout in fright, spreading their fright to him, and stand frozen while others turn and run. It's true that in the silence of the night the automobile is very loud, and he continues to honk the horn incessantly, but only to alert. At first there is hardly anyone about, but as he moves through the city like a blind creature scuttling at the bottom of the ocean, more and more people throw their shutters open, more and more people fling themselves into the streets, disheveled but sharp-eyed. He moves into second gear and outpaces them. A short while later, on another circuit through the city, he encounters more groups. He sees them, they see him. They run towards him, he turns down another street, he moves into third gear. If he cannot escape, then he must hide. After a series of turns halfway down a deserted avenue, he abruptly stops the machine. He hurries to blow out the flames of the sidelight and headlight. Darkness and silence engulf him. He listens. Will the night hordes find him? He ventures out. He peers around corners and stares down streets. Nothing but benign darkness. It seems he has lost them. He spends the rest of the night walking through Castelo Branco, establishing the route he will take at first light. During his nocturnal exploration of the city, he comes upon a plain square with its allotment of trees, benches, and a single statue veiled in darkness in its center. He sees movement, and he jumps, then realizes what it is. There has been a market that day in the square. The vendors' stalls still stand, and beneath the tables, strewn about, lies the bad produce that the vendors threw away, fruit, vegetables, perhaps even meat. Moving amidst this detritus are dogs. Under the great dome of the night, in the submarine quiet of a city returned to sleep after a brief disturbance, he gazes at these street dogs that are taking in what others have rejected. They go about their business with hopeful pokes and snuffles, occasionally finding and gratefully eating. A few of them look up and stare at him before returning to their rooting. They accept him as he accepts them. When he returns to the automobile, he feels the gratitude of a sea creature retreating into its sheltering shell. He lies down for a short nap in the cabin. Alas, the walking and the sleepless night have taxed him greatly. He oversleeps. At the honk of the machine's horn, pressed by some impertinent bystander, he wakes with a jerk to the sight of faces pressed through the window openings of the cabin, goggling eyes on him, noses sniffing the air. He has to push against the door of the cabin to move the people on the other side enough that he can squeeze out. He stands on the footboard and breathes in the fresh air of the new day. It is good to have escaped the night, but surrounding him now, sloshing and slapping against the automobile like the ocean's bright blue water, is seemingly the entire population of Castelo Branco, clamoring at him like breaking waves. His escape, involving the usual shouted exhortations, the usual blinkered lack of understanding, the usual surprise when the automobile nudges forward, and the usual race ahead of the mob, drains him utterly. He drives until his nodding head hits the steerage wheel. He wakes mid-afternoon and makes a groggy calculation. For each day established by a memory of it, the first day, the bridges, Ponte de Sor, the stagecoach, and so on, he raises a finger. Quickly the fingers of one hand stand erect. Then the fingers of the other, but for one. 9, if his calculation is correct. Today is his 9th day on the road. His meager ration of days is nearly expended. In 2 days, early in the morning, the chief curator at the museum will be expecting his return. He puts his head in his hands. Castelo Branco is not even halfway to his ultimate destination. Should he abandon his mission? But even if he does, he will not be back in Lisbon in time. To return now will be to fail twice, at his job and in his mission. to press on towards the high mountains of Portugal will be to fail only at his job. And if his mission is crowned with success, he might perhaps get his job back. He will carry on, then. He will persevere. That is the only sensible course. But night is coming. He will persevere tomorrow. With the changing land comes a changing climate. Winter in the Portuguese hinterland is cold and damp, and its bite is made worse by the metal cage that is the automobile's cabin and the drafts that blow through its broken windows. Tomás steps out. Beyond the faint gleam of the road, there is only blackness. He wonders, animals know boredom, but do they know loneliness? He doesn't think so. Not this kind of loneliness, of the body and the soul. He belongs to a lonely species. He returns to the sofa and wraps himself in the mink coat and three blankets. Perhaps he sleeps at odd moments, but if he does, he dreams that he is in the cabin of an automobile on a cold night, waiting, and so, awake or sleeping, he remains in the same state of misery. Through the hours, a question preoccupies him. When is Christmas? Did he miss it? In the morning, he is glad to get the machine going. The land continues to dry up, the cultivated weave plucked away, the sustaining frame of rock further exposed. The new landscape jumps out at him, luminous, the assertion of geology plain and direct. He begins to lose his way regularly. Until now, thanks to the maps, to the forbearance of roads, to luck, he has never got lost for very long. This changes after Castelo Branco. After Castelo Branco, the days blur into a fog of time. He drives into a village in despair, finds a local, and asks him, "Please, I've been looking for Rapola da Coa for 3 days. Where is it? In what direction does it lie?" The old villager looks in consternation at the smelly, distressed man in the smelly, distressing machine, whom he saw the previous day and the day before roaring through the village, and responds shyly, "This is Rapola da Coa." Lost elsewhere, Tomás begs to know where Almeida is, and the native smiles and cries out, "Almeida? No está aquí, hombre. Almeida está del otro lado de la frontera." Tomás stares at the man's mouth, aghast to hear the susurration of Portuguese replaced by the growl of Spanish. He races back to Portugal, fearful that the border he did not even notice will now rear up like an impassable mountain range. The compass is of no help. Always, no matter the road, it points away from the road into the wilderness, its needle trembling as he trembles. How one gets lost can vary, but the state of being lost, the feeling of it, is always the same: paralysis, anger, lethargy, despair. A pack of wolf children somewhere past Macedo de Caballeros pelt the machine with stones, gouging the elephant hide, denting the metal hood, and, worst of all, shattering the window of the driving compartment, so that he must now drive through howls of cold wind, wearing the motoring coat, goggles, and hat, but not the fine gloves, which burned to a crisp in the cabin fire. He has another flat tire, and this time he must actually repair the tire, since the tire on the footboard is already punctured. One afternoon, he at last reaches his destination. Invisibly, but the map telling him so, he enters the high mountains of Portugal. He can see it in the gentle lift in the land and in the increasing drop off the side of the road. He is jubilant. Soon, soon he will find the church he's been seeking, and his uncommon insight will be brilliantly demonstrated. His mission is nearly accomplished. What he has been saying with his backwards walking for a year, his outrage, his despair, he will now say with an unconventional crucifix. A broad smile illuminates his face. The road soon settles into a steady flatness. He looks to his left and right, perplexed. He discovers that he is driving through an act of national vanity. Every country yearns to flaunt that glittering jewel called a mountain range, and so this barren wasteland, too low to be alpine but too high to be usefully fertile, has been bedecked with a grand title. But there are no mountains in the high mountains of Portugal. There is nothing beyond mere hills, nothing Trás-os-Montes. It is an extensive, undulating, mostly treeless steppe, cool, dry, and bleached by a clear, dispassionate sunshine. Where he expected snow and rock, he finds a low, rampant, golden-yellow grass that stretches as far as the eye can see, occasionally interrupted by patches of forest. And the only summits he sees are strange, pockmarked boulders, enormous in size, the detritus of some geologic bustle. Streams here and there flow with unexpected liveliness. The steppe is, as its homophone implies, a temporary place from which one proceeds elsewhere. Historically, generations of hardscrabble locals have hurried away from its poor soil, emigrating to more clement parts of the world, and he finds that he too wishes to hurry through it. The villages he encounters concentrate the loneliness he feels in the wide-open spaces between them. Every man and woman he encounters, he doesn't see any children, smells of thyme and radiates solitude. These people live in plain, square, solid stone houses with shale roofs, the habitable spaces built above the animal pens, so that the two groups live in joint dependency, the humans receiving warmth and sustenance, the animals food and safety. The land is not amenable to extensive economic use. There is nothing but small, hardy fields of rye, large vegetable gardens, chestnut trees, beehives, chickens in profusion, pens of pigs, and roaming flocks of goats and sheep. The nights are of a coldness he didn't know existed in Portugal. He sleeps bundled up in blankets, wearing every item of clothing he can fit on. He cuts the canvas rain tarp into pieces and uses them to seal, more or less, the broken windows. This makes the cabin very dark. He burns candles inside it to heat it. One morning he awakes to a landscape of snow. It is mid-afternoon before it has melted enough for him to dare to drive on. Now that there is no front window, the driving is so cold that he must slow down. There are moments in the days when he recognizes a formal beauty to the landscape. It often has less to do with geography and more to do with the weather and the play of light. He does not get as lost as he did farther south, because there are fewer villages and fewer roads. But the roads are rutty obscenities laid down by an enterprising government long ago and forgotten by every government since. In fact, the whole region has the feel of living in administrative amnesia. And yet churches were built in the high mountains of Portugal as they were everywhere else in the country. Geography clamors for history. He studies the map and locates the five villages of São Julião de Palacios, Santalha, Mofreta, Guadramil, and Espinosela. If his research delivers on its promise, and it must, in one of these villages, washed up by the vagaries of history, he will find Father Ulysses' anguished creation. He first heads for the village of São Julião de Palacios. The wooden crucifix in its church is ordinary and unremarkable. The same with the centerpiece of the church of Guadramil. It is on the way to Espinosela that it happens. He awakes to a sharp dawn. The air is bright, odorless, dry, with none of the luxuriance of Portugal's coastal air. When he walks on the gravel at the side of the road, it crunches with parched crispness. A bird's cry startles him. He looks up. At that precise instant, a falcon collides from above with a dove. There is a wobble in the air, a flutter of loosened feathers, then a smooth banking as the falcon resumes its controlled flight with the dove crushed in its talons. It flaps its wings and gains altitude. Tomas watches it vanish in the distance. An hour or so later, the road he is driving along is open and flat, as is the land on either side. Just then, above the snout of the automobile's hood, the child appears. More precisely, its hand. The sight is so odd, so unexpected, that he cannot believe what he has seen. Was it a branch? No, it was most certainly a small hand. If a child were holding on to the front of the automobile and stood up, that's where its hand would appear. And if a child were holding on to the front of the automobile and slipped off, it would then fall under the moving machine. What is the sound of a body being run over by an automobile? Clearly, it is what he has just heard, a sound soft, swift, and thumping. His mind moves in that alternately slow and abrupt way of a mind that is jarred. He must check on the child. Perhaps it is hurt, or at the very least, frightened. If there even was a child. He sticks his head out of the driving compartment and looks back. He sees behind him, receding, a lump, small and still. He halts the machine and steps out. He removes his hat and goggles. He is breathless. The lump is far off. He walks backwards towards it. Every time he turns his head, it is closer and his chest feels tighter. He walks faster. His heart is jumping in his chest. He turns around and runs forward towards the lump. It is indeed a child. A boy, perhaps 5 or 6 years old, dressed in overlarge clothes. A peasant boy with a large head, surprisingly blonde hair, and a lovely, harmonious face marred only by streaks of dirt. And what Portuguese eyes are these? Blue? Some atavism, some trace of the foreign. Their fixed gaze appalls him.
Boy, are you all right? Boy?
The last word he says louder, as if death were a hearing problem. The boy's eyes do not blink. His pale face remains frozen in a grave expression. Tomas kneels and touches the boy's chest. He feels only stillness. A small river of blood appears from under the body and flows along the ground in the usual way of rivers. Tomas shudders. He lifts his head. A breeze is blowing. In whatever direction he looks, there is majestic normalcy. Wild growth here, tilled fields over there, the road, the sky, the sun. Everything is in its place, and time is moving with its usual discretion. Then, in an instant, without any warning, a little boy tripped everything up. Surely the fields will notice. They will rise, dust themselves, and come closer to take a concerned look. The road will curl up like a snake and make sad pronouncements. The sun will darken with desolation. Gravity itself will be upset, and objects will float in existential hesitation. But no. The fields remain still. The road continues to lie hard and fixed, and the morning sun does not stop shining with unblinking coolness. Tomas thinks back to the last place he stopped. It was just a few kilometers earlier. He had a short nap, his forehead resting against the steerage wheel, the engine left running. Could the child have climbed onto the front of the automobile during that break, while his head was down, unnoticed by him? Children will play. This could well be something Gaspar would have done, climbed onto a warm, throbbing machine to see what it was like.
"I'm sorry, little one," he whispers.
He gets back to his feet. What is there to do but leave? He walks away in his usual fashion, and so the child remains in his sight. He churns with horror. Then a hand seizes that horror and stuffs it in a box and closes the lid. If he leaves quickly enough, it will not have happened. For the moment, this accident is in himself only, a private mark, a notch carved nowhere but upon his sensibility, Outside him, nothing cares. Look for yourself. The wind blows. Time flows. Besides, it was an accident. It just happened, with no intent or knowledge on his part.
He turns and runs. Upon arriving at the front of the automobile to pull on the starting handle, he sees that the small lid of the hood is open. This lid is at the very front of the hood, out of sight of the driver in the driving compartment, and is designed to allow access to the engine without the hood having to be lifted. Did the child see it as a door into a little round dollhouse? Why must children be so curious? He notes how the boy would have held on, where his feet might have rested, what his hands must have gripped. The edge of the chassis, the base of the starting handle, the ends of the suspension springs, the thin rods that hold the headlights into place, the rim of the open lid, so many options for a little monkey. Comfortable enough a perch, perhaps even exhilarating when the warm, noisy machine jerked into motion, but then fear and fatigue would have set in. So much speed and shaking, the ground disappearing beneath like a watery torrent. He closes the lid and turns the starting handle. He hastens back to the driving compartment, puts the machine into first gear. He pauses. He considers what lies behind him and what lies ahead. With a shudder, the machine starts to move. He presses harder on the pedal. The automobile gains speed. He puts it into second gear, then third. He looks in the side mirror. The image is shaky, but he can still make out the lump. He turns his eyes to the road ahead. He does not drive very far. The road snakes and ascends into a forest of pine trees. He stops. He turns the engine off. He sits. Then he lifts his gaze to look out the painless window. Through the trees he sees the road he was on earlier. He is already far from that road, but nothing catches the eye like movement. He sees a tiny figure, just a speck. The figure is running. He recognizes that it's a man from the sparks of light that flash through the running legs. The man runs, and then he stops. He falls forward. There is no movement for a long time. Then the man gets up, lifts the bundle off the road, and walks back the way he came. Tomas's inner being plummets. To be the victim of a theft, and now to have committed a theft. In both cases, a child stolen. In both cases, his goodwill and grieving heart of no consequence. In both cases, mere chance. There is suffering, and there is luck, and once again his luck has run out. He suddenly feels swallowed, as if he were a struggling insect floating on water and a great mouth gulped him in. After a long time, he looks away. He gets the automobile into gear and pushes on. The Church of Espinosela yields no treasure, nor does the Church of Mofreta. There is only the Church of Santalla left. If Father Ulysses' crucifix is not there, what will he do next? On the road to Santalla, he begins to feel ill. The pain comes in waves, and at each wave it seems to him that he can feel the exact outline of his stomach. Within that outline, he is gripped by cramps. Relief comes, only for another cramp to hit him. Nausea surges through him next. Its onset is violent. Saliva floods his mouth, and the taste of it, its very presence, increases the nausea. He halts the vehicle and hastily exits it, trembling and covered in a cold sweat. He falls to his knees. Vomit erupts out of his mouth, a white torrent that splatters the grass. It reeks of putrid cheese. He is left panting. The urge returns with unstoppable force, and he retches again. At the end of it, bile is burning his throat. He lurches back to the automobile. He examines himself in a side mirror. He is scruffy and wild-eyed. His hair is sticky and matted. His clothes are unrecognizably dirty. He looks like a skewer of roasted meat. he spends a grim, sleepless night, haunted by a pair of blue eyes, by a sad, solemn little face, his stomach clenching and unclenching. It dawns on him he is sick because of the child. The child is pushing from within him. That morning he enters a village named Tuizelo. The day is sunny, but the village square is deserted. He gets down from the automobile and drinks from the fountain at the center of the square. He should clean himself, but he cannot muster the will or the concern. Instead, he goes searching for somewhere to buy a little food. In these small villages in the high mountains of Portugal, where the inhabitants survive largely on a mix of self-sufficiency and barter, he has discovered that sometimes a private house acts as an informal shop. But even this is not to be found in Tuizelo. Only large vegetable gardens and wandering animals. The village is, in fact, full of animals. Cats, dogs, chickens, ducks, sheep, goats, cows, donkeys, songbirds. As he is returning to the automobile, another stomach cramp besets him. As he pauses to steady himself, he catches sight of the village church. It is a squat building, plain and simple, though not unattractive for it. Its pale stone glows appealingly in the sunlight. He is of the opinion that architectural modesty best suits the religious sentiment. Only song needs to soar in a church. Anything fancier is human arrogance disguised as faith. A church such as Tuizelo's, with no high pointed arches, no ribbed vaulting, no flying buttresses, more accurately reflects the true humble nature of the seeker who enters its walls. The church is not on his list, but visiting it might distract him from his aching stomach and guilty sorrow. The two doors he tries are locked. As he steps away, he catches sight of a woman. She is standing looking at him from a little way off. "Father Abrahan has gone fishing for the day. I have the key, if you would like," she says. He hesitates. There is more driving to be done, with great uncertainty ahead. But she is offering, and it doesn't escape his notice. The woman is beautiful. A peasant beauty. It lifts his spirits while dashing them at the same time. Once he had a beautiful woman in his life. "That would be kind of you, Senora." She tells him her name is Maria Doris Passos Castro, and that he should wait. She disappears around a corner. While he waits for her return, he sits on the step of the church. It is a relief to be approached by a lone woman. He is grateful that no mob has descended on him in this lost village. Senora Castro returns. She produces an enormous iron key. "The custodian of the church is my husband, Rafael Miguel Santos Castro, but he is away for the week." With much clanging and grinding, she unlocks and opens the door to the church. She moves aside to let him in. "Thank you," he says. The interior is dim because the windows are narrow and because he has just walked in from bright sunlight. He walks to the center of the nave, to the single aisle between the rows of pews. He is preoccupied with his stomach. If only the child would stop pushing. He is afraid he will vomit inside the church. He hopes Senora Castro will not follow him too closely. She doesn't. She stands back and leaves him in peace. His eyes grow accustomed to the muted light. Stone pilasters connected by arched moldings frame the white stucco walls around him. The capitals atop the pilasters are plain. Other than a commonplace pictorial Stations of the Cross, the walls are bare, and the windows have no stained glass. He makes his way in reverse along the nave. It is all sober and simple. He takes the church for what it aims to be, a shelter, a refuge, a harbor. He is so weary. He notices the church's narrow windows, the thick walls, and the barrel-vaulted ceiling. The Romanesque style arrived late and died late in Portugal. This appears to be a typical small Romanesque church, unmarked by time and unmodified by later hands. A forgotten 7 centuries old church.
"How old is the church?" he calls.
13th century, the woman replies.
He is pleased to learn that he has identified it correctly. He backs up the aisle slowly, dropping his feet with care. The transepts appear, containing no surprises. He turns around to face the altar, lowering himself into a pew in the second row. He takes long, deep breaths. He glances at the altar and at the crucifix above it. The crucifix is not the standard issue maudlin symbol he has found almost everywhere. It seems to be early Renaissance. Christ's long face, elongated arms, and foreshortened legs speak of an awkward attempt by the artist to correct the distortions caused by viewing an elevated figure from below. The extended arms and reduced legs make the body look normal to the viewer looking up at it. The work is no Mantegna or Michelangelo, but it's expressive. The face of Christ, especially so, nearly baroque in its emotional eloquence. It's a worthy attempt to express the humanity of Christ and juggle with perspective circa the early 15th century. He is going to throw up. He clamps his mouth shut. "Child, stop!" He stands and steadies himself. He makes his way backwards down the aisle, and as he is about to turn for the door, lets his eyes sweep through the church one last time. His eyes rest on the crucifix again. A point of stillness makes itself felt within him, a point that becalms not only the troubles of his body, but also the rash workings of his brain. To place one foot in front of the other feels unnatural, but he does not want to take his eyes off the crucifix. He walks forward. The crucifix is not Renaissance. It's more recent than that. In fact, he is certain of its date, 1635. It is indeed Baroque, then, what might be called African Baroque. Unmistakably, what he is staring at is Father Ulysses' crucifix. There it is, all the way from Sao Tome. Oh, what a marvel! The match between what Father Ulysses wrote in his diary and fashioned with his hands is perfect. The arms, the shoulders, the hanging body, the curled legs, and above all, the face. Now that he is properly taking in what his eyes are seeing, the crucifix indeed shines and shrieks, barks and roars. Truly, this is the Son of God giving a loud cry and breathing his last breath as the curtain of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. "Excuse me," he cries out to Senora Castro. She takes a few steps. He points with his arm and finger. He points to the heart of the church and asks her, "What is that?" The woman looks bemused. "It is our Lord Jesus Christ." "Yes, but how is he represented?"
"Suffering on the cross."
"But what form has he taken?"
"The form of a man. God so loved us that he gave us his Son," she replies simply.
"No!" shouts Tomas, smiling, though every muscle in his midsection is twisting. "What you have here is a chimpanzee, an ape. It's clear in his sketch, the facial hair, the nose, the mouth. He's feathered away the hair, but the features are unmistakable once you know. And those long arms and short legs, they're not stylized, they're simian. Chimpanzees have limbs exactly like that, long in the upper body and short in the lower. Do you understand? You've been praying to a crucified chimpanzee all these years. Your Son of Man is not a god. He's just an ape on a cross." It is done. This Christ on the cross, once it is displayed and widely known, will mock all the others. He whispers his private business, "There. You took my Son, now I take yours." He wants his laughter to be light, but his victory is blighted by an onrushing emotion, a plummeting feeling of sadness. He fights it. Here is the truth about Jesus of Nazareth, the biological reality. All science points to the materiality of our condition. As an aside, the crucifix is breathtakingly beautiful, and to him will go the glory of discovering it and bringing it to the museum. Still, the feeling of sadness quickly deepens. He stares at Father Ulysses' crucified ape. Not a god, only an animal. As he flees the church, a hand pressed to his mouth, a gospel verse unexpectedly rings in his head. Jesus has just been arrested after the betrayal of Judas. The disciples have deserted him and fled. And then, from Mark, a certain young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen cloth. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and ran off naked. Is he not now similarly naked? Señora Castro watches him go, struck by his strange backwards gait. He looks as if a wind were sucking him out of the church. She does not follow him. Instead, she approaches the altar and peers up at the crucifix. What was the man saying? An ape? The Jesus she sees has long arms because he's welcoming, and a long face because he's doleful. She has never seen anything odd about the crucifix. The artist did his best. Besides, she pays more attention to Father Abraham, and she prays with her eyes closed. It's just a crucifix. And if he's an ape, so be it, he's an ape. He's still the Son of God. She decides she should check on the stranger. Tomas is leaning against the automobile, retching violently. From his rectum to his throat, he is a single, constricting muscle at the mercy of the child who is wringing him like a wet rag. From the corner of his eye, he sees a priest appear in the square, holding a fishing rod in one hand and a line of three fish in the other. Father Abraham beholds Maria Pasos Castro, who has a puzzled look on her face. He beholds one of those new fashionable carriages he's heard about, but this one in very poor condition, and he beholds a bedraggled stranger next to it, dry heaving with mighty roars. Tomas climbs into the driving compartment. He wants to go. In a daze, he looks at the steerage wheel. The machine needs to move to the right to avoid the wall next to it. What does that mean in terms of the rotation of the wheel in his hands? Grief surges through him ahead of his capacity to answer the question. The steerage wheel has finally and truly defeated him. He begins to weep. He weeps because he feels horribly sick. He weeps because he is soul-racked and bone-weary, tired of driving the machine. He weeps because his ordeal is only half over. He still has to drive all the way back to Lisbon. He weeps because he is unwashed and unshaved. He weeps because he has spent days on end in foreign lands and nights on end sleeping in an automobile, cold and cramped. He weeps because he has lost his job, and what will he do next? How will he earn his living? He weeps because he has discovered a crucifix he no longer cares to have discovered. He weeps because he misses his father. He weeps because he misses his son and his lover. He weeps because he has killed a child. He weeps because. He weeps like a child, catching his breath and hiccuping, his face drenched with tears. We are random animals. That is who we are, and we have only ourselves, nothing more. There is no greater relationship. Long before Darwin, a priest, lucid in his madness, encountered four chimpanzees on a forlorn island in Africa and hit upon a great truth. We are risen apes, not fallen angels. Tomas is strangled by loneliness.
Father, I need you, he cries out.
Father Abraham throws his fishing gear to the ground and runs to help the piteous stranger. Part 2. Homeward. Eusebio Lozora says the Lord's Prayer three times slowly.
After that, he launches forth with unrehearsed praise and supplication. His thoughts wander but return. His sentences stop midway but eventually resume. He praises God, then he praises his wife to God. He asks God to bless her and their children. He asks for God's continued support and protection. Then, since he is a physician, a pathologist at that, rooted in the body, but also a believer, rooted in the promise of the Lord, he repeats, perhaps 24 times, the words, "the body of Christ," after which he gets up off his knees and returns to his desk. He considers himself a careful practitioner. He examines the paragraph he has been working on the way a farmer might look back at a freshly sowed furrow